male nudity, female nudity, simulated sex, attempted rape, heavy violence.
That's ahead on the show that simulates all forms of action. You're listening to The Fourth Estate. I'm Mick Caldwell, and today it's a pleasure to be joined by two-thirds of Team Fourth Estate, Nathan Coates and Ellie Schneider. Also ahead on the show...
There is another issue here, which is really about a transformation in journalism itself. The emergence of journalists who haven't been formally trained, who aren't affiliated with established media organisations, who are now going out and doing it themselves.
I look into the growth of citizen journalism in the face of dangerous regimes.
And later on, how our theatres have stimulated controversy centre stage.
So do stay tuned here on The Fourth Estate. Within the remote areas of Central Australia, a handful of Northern Territory communities have felt a sense of mojo rising. But in this case, mojo is a clever reference to mobile journalist, which 11 selected members found themselves becoming with just an iPhone, as well as a week's worth of intensive training. Now published on the World Wide Web, the NT Mojo project was born from an idea that came out of media producer Evo Burram, who worked alongside the Territory's Bachelor Institute for Indigenous Tertiary Education, located 100 kilometres south of Darwin. The project received funding from the Department of Families, Housing, Community Services and Indigenous Affairs, or FACSIA, as part of an overall effort in bridging the gap.
Hello, we are Kaluin Kojos.
Stay tuned and look out for a great story coming out soon.
My name's Evo Burram, and I was the executive producer on this project. I developed the concept, and then we found some funding through the government, through FACSIA, and then I partnered with Bachelor Institute to actually deliver it, because it needed a home in the NT, and Bachelor, of course, will give it that.
The unit's senior lecturer and head of media is Linda McCaffrey.
It isn't the way we run our usual year-long certificate and diploma courses. It was a quite special way of doing it. The model, if you think about the ABC's Race Around the World project, it kind of was a bit like a race around the NT, because what we did was we worked through the government's people on the ground and the elders in the communities and media teachers and coordinators in the communities, and we asked them to recommend people in their communities who they thought might be really interested in doing this kind of thing.
Hey Liam, what's going on?
Well, everybody's stressed out because we're supposed to have a holiday tomorrow and nobody can get out of the community to have the holiday.
And in the end we chose 9 mojos from 6 communities, Galawinku, Ramangini, Numbuwa, Nuyu on Bathurst Island.
All that was needed to be known was condensed down to a 5-day intensive workshop that dealt with everything from practices to production.
I wrote a training manual, and we used that to teach them a little bit about journalism, and then about the iPhone, and then about the video and editing app. And then once they'd done that, they then went back to their communities for 4 weeks of filming.
My people have lived off the land for 40,000 years, and the bush is our natural pharmacy. My sister Aggie learned all about bush medicines from our parents.
And I'm looking for all the bush medicine to find good bush medicine for our children and make all the children back to normal. Yeah, this is my father's homeland.
If you know, in our kit was a mobile phone, and we put that into a little device called an Ali that held that, and it gave you much better quality of panning and tilting and stuff. We put a microphone on and a light on that. So really, they were still using a phone, but none of that stuff seemed to be foreign to them.
It's Greek music, but we on Elko Island.
We helped them with the objectivity. We helped them with the way that, you know, they would structure their stories. This was all part of the ongoing training. We would talk to them about what they would write in the voiceovers.
The joke is new superstar on YouTube. But every morning, they clean them all.
I went down to help Sabrina with her... her natural life story, which is the story about not using petrol in Gelawinku. She had already decided and done and shot the drama reconstruction in that. That was her decision. That was her decision about being objective about this, about a way that she could actually do it and stay outside of the personal stuff. Because had she talked about to a lot of the sniffers, they would have been people that she knew, and it would have been a very emotional, subjective view. So they were thinking about that all along, and journalism is journalism. You have to be, in the end, objective.
Hi, my name is Rudolf Mungon, and I'm the new Numbua Mojo, and I'm going to bring you lots of stories from Numbua, so watch out.
Helping close the gap through local stories of change and hope is the catch cry the government certainly wishes to drive home, closing the gap in terms of past relations within the territory.
To give Indigenous knowledge as much grounding as we give Western knowledge. And those things really matter to the organisation. When we worked hand in hand with Evo Burram and Burram Media, we worked to ask the government to support a project that would help Indigenous people control the stories that they tell. It was important to us, as you know, people who worked in the media who care about journalism and free speech, that the control of the story suggestions and largely the perspective of the story was the Mojos.
Here's the other thing. There is another gap after education. When you educate people, what happens then? How do you get them jobs in the communities, which is where you really need them to go after they're educated, so that they can pass on their pride and their skills to other people in the communities? That's the way it works.
We see stories that are negative about Aboriginal people all the time. And what these guys were doing was having this great opportunity to tell all these positive stories, things that actually are about bringing Indigenous and non-Indigenous people closer together. So if that's where the gap is, then I think that the power of storytelling, of sharing your community with other people, of telling people about all the good things that are happening in your community.
The whole nature of storytelling is, in a sense, dying, because we're not getting that full, complete story. So one of the things that we're pushing with the Mojo concept is to give birth to this whole notion of storytelling, albeit now, you know, using a modern approach. These Indigenous people are the oldest storytellers in the world. All we were doing is helping them tell their stories in short form.
That was Evo Burram, the director of Burram Media, behind NT Mojos. Now, the official website is ntmojos.indigenous.gov.au, and also check out where it all originated from. Go to burrammedia.com.au, which is B-U-R-U-M, and we will be posting links from the show website.
Since the Libyan conflict escalated in February, the Committee to Protect Journalists, or CPJ, has reported the deaths of 4 media personnel and the detention of 49. One death not reported by CPJ was that of citizen journalist Mohamed Nabous. In telling the Libyan story, Mr. Nabous was shot dead by pro-Gaddafi forces. Citizen journalism is growing in the face of dangerous regimes and may be particularly relevant in Libya, where high levels of civilian casualties are being reported. I spoke with Tom Morton, director at the Australian Centre for Independent Journalism.
I became aware of his work as a citizen journalist in Libya through reporting on the ABC's PM program, which had picked up on his Twitter feeds and then got in touch with him. He was plainly a very brave man, somebody who took the initiative quite early on in the conflict in Libya. He basically jury-rigged this makeshift TV station with a satellite dish on the roof and then went out in the field and started reporting. He had a team of people, citizen video journalists, working for him. In the Committee to Protect Journalists reporting on the threats and dangers, some cases deaths of journalists in Libya, they didn't mention the case of Mahabir Nabuz. And what I think is interesting here is that that in a sense expresses a larger tendency, which is for the Western media to focus on the killing of Western journalists or journalists who have some affiliation with the Western media. I mean, I think that there is another issue here, which is really about a transformation in journalism itself, the emergence of citizen journalists, journalists who haven't been formally trained and who aren't affiliated with established media organisations, who are now going out and doing it themselves.
And particularly in cases where it is almost impossible for outside journalists or even journalists of that country to report on what's happening. The case of Mahabir Nabuz was particularly relevant and inspiring because no one dared to report on what was going on. Journalists couldn't get in, yet Mr. Nabuz effectively gave his life in order to report the story of Libya.
I really recommend to anyone who's interested to go onto the ABC website and listen to the PM report about his death, because you really hear, first of all, the exhilaration that he felt at being able finally to speak freely and to he says in his very first broadcast, you know, we don't care whether we die or not, what we want is freedom. What is happening to journalists, in a sense, is part of a larger trend, which is for increasingly for civilians to be regarded as legitimate targets in military conflicts.
Given the difficulties that journalists and citizens alike face in places like Libya, are we likely to see more citizen journalists?
Oh, look, yes, I think so. Yeah, I think that, I mean, I think basically in those situations where there has been such rigid control of the media for so long in countries like Libya, Egypt, Syria, Saudi Arabia, Bahrain, etc., I think it will be impossible to stop brave people like Mahabir Nabuz taking the initiative under those circumstances, and you know, nor would anyone want to stop them, really. Unfortunately now, anybody who threatens the authority or control of regimes such as the Libyan regime is seen as a legitimate target.
So we're caught in this kind of difficult situation where, as you say, it is, in a sense, to use one of a better term, open season on civilians, journalists, and as you say, anybody who, you know, resists the incumbent regime. In one sense, you've got people, you know, ducking for cover and not wanting to go there because of the circumstances, yet it is those exact circumstances that need to be reported.
Precisely. And I think that there's a tension too between the desire of journalists to report, to get close to the action, and there was a nice phrase used in one of the elegies that was published on the web for Tim Hetherington. One of his friends said that he'd gone to Misurata in Libya armed only with his own resourcefulness, which I think is a very nice tribute to both Tim Hetherington himself and to the spirit of journalists who do want to do that, who believe it's their duty as journalists to bear witness to what's happening in the world and to bear witness to the sufferings of ordinary people in situations like this.
What role does journalism play? Can it really affect the outcome?
Oh, sure it can affect the outcome. I mean, I think there's absolutely no doubt that the UN Security Council resolution, which has allowed that to happen, I think there's absolutely no doubt that that would not have happened had there not been journalists on the ground in Libya reporting at the stage when it appeared that Gaddafi's forces were going to drive the rebels all the way back to Benghazi and then, if it seemed likely that they might also take Benghazi. I think if they hadn't been reporting at that crucial turning point, then those actions wouldn't have been taken by NATO and by the United Nations. So, yeah, journalists played a crucial role.
That was Tom Morton, director at the Australian Centre for Independent Journalism.
It's an age-old artistic trope, the human condition being exposed. But as a new generation of theatre makers continues to push the boundaries, and the actors literally nude up, audience members are often left squirming in their seats. While a number of recent productions arouse some theatregoers, drama teachers across Australia say the time has come for ratings classifications for live theatre. Drama Victoria is the largest drama teacher association in Australia. I caught up with President Justin Cash.
There's a lot of theatre in Australia at the moment that certainly is more confronting than it used to be. Lots more nudity. I mean, gone are the days where you sort of had the little advisory warning in the foyer saying they're using herbal cigarettes in this production or a strobe light. Baal was the big example in Melbourne recently, and I think it's soon to come up to Sydney at the STC, where it was definitely one of the most confronting plays I've seen. All cast members completely naked. So you had male nudity, female nudity, simulated sex, attempted rape, heavy violence.
Are there circumstances in which theatre companies should deny entry to a show based on age?
Theatre companies around Australia, the professional companies, perhaps need to get together with an agreed code of practice on their advisory warnings. I don't know about denying entry. I think that's tricky. But certainly, you know, we have advisory warnings and a formal classification system with publications and DVDs and films, etc., that I suppose certainly are restricted and can, you know, deny you from purchasing that material or viewing that film. But in theatre, I think, you know, there's nothing wrong with certainly having the advisory warnings saying, you know, unsuitable, perhaps like the M rating for the films and DVDs.
Occasionally, theatre companies do choose to give audiences advance warnings of graphic scenes, but is this enough, or do we need a more formal classification system?
We do need a formal classification system. I don't see any difference between live theatre and a film in terms of the person watching it and experiencing it. The difficulty with a formal classification system for live theatre, of course, will be where's the time gap for the classification to occur between the finished product that has been reviewed by a classification board and then presenting it. I mean, in order to be classified, it would have to be the finished product, and, you know, we go from dress rehearsal to opening night in a matter of minutes in the theatre, and there's no gap in between like there is with film, where it can sit and wait to be classified by the Australian Classification Board and then be approved for release at retail.
At its core, isn't theatre an emotional experience designed to be challenging and provocative?
It is designed to be challenging and provocative, but can you go too far? I think this is the question. Contemporary theatre certainly has more violence in it in Australia and more nudity. What's acceptable? Well, every audience has a different experience, and every audience member there on one night has a different experience, sitting in different seats, coming in there with different biases and prejudices, all having a different experience. I mean, you know, some people walk out of plays and halfway through because they don't think it's acceptable. Other people will rave that it was the best theatre show that they've been to. So,
do you think because it's live it is more confronting?
It definitely is. Yes, it is more confronting. In the theatre, it's live. It's a living thing. It's there in front of you. Film, in many ways, is a dead art. It's chopped up on the editing board many months before you see it, and you're watching it on a screen.
Brenna Hobson is general manager at Belvoir Theatre in Sydney. She says the suggestion that content is getting increasingly graphic is incorrect, and that a classification framework is simply not practical.
It's an issue that's a little bit of a bubble, really. You know, the sorts of content that people have been talking about with productions like Baal, that sort of content has actually been around for a very long time.
What would be the challenge of a classification system?
One of the things that is incredibly special about the performing arts, and specifically theatre and specifically new work, is that you are altering what you do right up until opening night and sometimes beyond that. Now, we would always do everything that we can to warn our audience members about anything that might offend them or anything that might make them uncomfortable, but the ability to give artists room to change things, to respond when things aren't working, to keep crafting, means that practically trying to have some sort of a classification system, I think, would be counterproductive.
Do you think that companies across Australia could create their own agreed code of conduct for content suitability?
Look, I think what you find is that informally there is, and what organisations tend to do is respond very much to their audience base. An organisation like Glen Street is much more sensitive to things like swearing because that they know that that's something that their audience base is sensitive to. In terms of our work, language isn't so much of an issue, but depending on who we've got coming to a performance will really change how we warn people. So I think the ability to respond to your audience specifically is actually much more important than a blanket ruling.
Would a classification scheme hinder the theatrical experience, as often nudity, sexuality or violence is integral to the play's narrative?
There is the potential for that. I mean, the other thing to bear in mind is that theatre is an act of collective imagining. We all walk into a play knowing that violence isn't actually happening, whereas you can see actual violence on 7 o'clock news. From the very first theatrical experiences that we've been creating as a kind of species, we've dealt with the big issues of our time, and that will necessarily involve issues of morality, sex, violence, war, things that aren't comfortable. And I think you have to respect your audience's intelligence and ability to make a decision about whether that's something they want to see or not.
Do you believe that theatre makers should be pushing the boundaries even further?
Look, I don't believe in graphic content for its own sake, but I think theatre artists always have an obligation to tackle the big, difficult issues. That's what the theatrical conversation is about. If those issues are uncomfortable, then yes, they should push them. Hare, Barry Kosky's work, we've been through a period, you know, when nudity, when pseudo bodily fluids were shocking. They're not shocking in and of themselves anymore.
That was Brenna Hobson, General Manager at Belvoir Theatre Sydney. As much as I did try to engage with STC, they felt their piece had already been said.
Just to take an opportunity to thank the funding support that comes from the Humanities and Social Sciences Department at the University of Technology Sydney and the Faculty of Arts at Macquarie University. The Australian National University, or ANU, has just released a poll claiming that those of you interacting with the nation's politicians via social media are in turn more involved with politics. The poll also addresses social interaction, which has always been a key aspect of Web 2.0's function, through such components as blogs and online forums. Apparently, all those Facebook pokes and likes are making us more interactive on a global scale. The internet is quickly transforming our views on citizenship so that talking on Skype can be held within the same regard as a boardroom meeting. Co-author of the poll, Professor Ian McAllister, spoke to Annie Wiley about how your internet use affects the way that you think.
Well, what we do with the ANU poll is it's a national survey of normally about 1,200 people aged 18 and above that we conduct by telephone. For each ANU poll, we have a particular topic, and the topic for this poll was the internet and civil society. We were interested in the view that which you find quite a lot in the media and various other places, that the internet divides society, that there's a digital divide and it creates a very atomized society where people have difficulty relating one to another. So we were interested in the extent to which in virtual civil society this increased people's sense of trust with others, how it enhanced civil society and so on. And what we found was a fairly positive view that if people did engage with one another in the virtual world through social media and various other means on the internet, then that actually created social trust and in turn social capital, and that had consequences for people's views of politics. And one of the things we did find, which we've done quite a bit of research on, is that the more people use the internet, particularly during the course of election campaigns and if they visit particular sites and so on, then they do have greater levels of political knowledge. And we know that political knowledge enhances things like political efficacy, political trust, and a greater satisfaction with democracy.
So people that don't have the internet, for instance, in this most recent election, perhaps weren't making as informed and politically aware decisions as those that were using the internet?
I wouldn't necessarily say that. They were perhaps deriving their information from other sources. What we did find was that people that used the internet more frequently for gathering information about the election, who logged into websites that the political parties use, or the Federal Parliament website, or the Australian Electoral Commission, actually had greater levels of political knowledge.
Of course, you can say that the internet promotes social interaction with, as the report has said, other races, people from other countries. But is that really indicative of an increasingly social society when it's simply through things like emails and Facebook wall posts?
What we've seen with Web 2.0 and the social media is virtually a parallel virtual civil society where people are able to engage with each other in discussion groups, in blogs, in online meetings, and so on. So we were interested in testing that to see to what extent that enhanced people's political trust, as we know that the real world civil society does. And we find that the effects were really very similar. If people did engage in Web 2.0 activities, this was very analogous to ordinary civil society, to personal interactions. And I think that's really very important for the future of the internet and the implications that it has for things like citizenship. Really, virtual civil society is starting to replace other aspects of ordinary civil society.
You mentioned the idea of good citizenship, and in the report it talks about certain percentages of society who do use the internet believing that you must support those who are worse off than yourself, and various notions like that. Is this to do with being able to do more research and having a greater awareness because of the internet, or just a coincidental correlation between the two?
What we were interested there in looking at citizenship was the idea that people supported the norms of citizenship. And what we found was that people that used the internet tended to have a slightly different view of citizenship to people that were less frequent users of the internet or didn't use it at all. And I suppose the traditional view of citizenship was very much associated with duty. So things like obeying laws, jury service. The newer version of citizenship focuses on things like engagement. So really a different conception of citizenship. And what we've seen with the internet is that it tends to focus on this engaged aspect of citizenship, where this old, more traditional view of citizenship involving duty is something that's not quite as much emphasized.
Do you think that this change in the set of norms for people's views of citizenship will change permanently, so that even those not using the internet begin to take on that idea?
One view of the internet is that it undermines citizenship, that it's something that erodes personal contacts. The alternative view is that citizenship is evolving, that the internet presents new and much more interesting ways of doing things. So, for example, in the past, while people might have joined political parties, today they're much more likely to get involved politically through the social media, through things like GetUp and so on. So there's an evolution of citizenship, and I think that latter view is the one that probably most people would hold who do research in this area, that the notion of citizenship and how citizenship equates with democracy in the 21st century is really undergoing a change. And it seems to us that a major driver behind that change is the way people use the internet, the way they're able to contact each other, and the way this sense of virtual civil society works. Political parties, for example, have not reacted very well to the internet. They've not developed it. They've not used it to its best advantage. And I think over the next 5-10 years or so, we'll see the political parties, certainly in Australia, being much more adept at using the social media to try and attract support. And I think that'll be a real change.
AN News, Professor Ian McAllister, chatting there to Annie Wiley, discussing the poll which dissects our usage of social media and how it adds to our sense of citizenship. And that wraps up another edition here on the Fourth Estate. And don't forget, you can always access past episodes, story files, or just say g'day by heading along to our website, which is fourthestateradio.blogspot.com.
I'm Ellie Schneider.
I'm Nathan Coates.
I'm Mick Caldwell. I'll catch you again next week.